One of the things I really like about working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and really, there are oodles and oodles of things to like, is that we have uniforms. And not just any uniforms, but really sharp-looking brown uniforms with a stylish logo of blues, white, orange, and yellow. A part of my appreciation for our uniforms is that I do genuinely think that they look good. Another part of it is that it keeps me from having to think about what I'm going to wear each morning, and probably that's a good thing. I've never even been a paid employee to fashion, let alone a slave to it. Actually, my take on fashion and what's popular is, if I find the things I like and stick with them for long enough, eventually everyone will catch up with me from time to time, as evidenced by the fact that I've been bald and bearded for a very long time and have no plans to change that winning formula. And let's face it, fashion changes so quickly, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. For example, I'd like to think that bell bottoms will never seriously make a comeback, though the chances are at some point they will. On the other hand, I'd be perfectly fine if beards, hoodies, and sandals never went out of style. But I'm sure they will, and probably sooner rather than later. And what's with baseball-style caps and wearing them with a flat, uncreased bill? All that does is tell me that the person wearing it is not smart enough to know how to deal with his hat. If you're not going to add a bit of curve to your bill, for crying out loud, cover it up with something. Like maybe a bunch of bird feathers. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. All right, that might have sounded a bit weird, but it did do a couple of things. First, it served to call attention to the fact that flat-billed hats are a blight on society and need to be dealt with. I'll admit that bird feathers probably aren't the way to go, but they do pave the way for today's episode, which is the second thing, and that's to share about how large bird feathers, called plumes, used to be the height of fashion, at least for women, and how those plumes led to a magnificent conservation success story, the National Wildlife Refuge System. You see, next week is National Wildlife Refuge Week, a pretty big week for us and one of my busiest weeks of the year. We celebrate the National Wildlife Refuge System, and I always make it a point to look back on just how things came about, being something of a history buff and all. And the fact is, we can trace the beginnings to the plume trade, those large bird feathers, and fashion industry of the late 1800s that made them such a valuable commodity. Plume hunting, by definition, is the hunting of wild birds, mostly large birds, to harvest their feathers, especially the larger, more decorative plumes called aigrettes. The plume trade was at its height for a couple of decades at the end of the late 19th century, and then really started to fizzle in the early years of the 20th century. Thing is, when hunting is unrestricted, and it was back then, it doesn't take a whole lot of years to do a great deal of damage. As the 1890s wound to a close, plume hunters had basically wiped out the entire snowy egret population of the United States, and severely crippled populations for a number of other species, including flamingos, spoonbills, and pelicans. And just why were these feathers needed? Victorian-era women's fashion in the form of large, ornate hats with wide brims, decorated in elaborate creations of silk flowers, ribbons, and exotic plumes. In fact, some hats had not just the plumes, but the whole bird in the form of stuffed birds attached to the hat. I kid you not. You might not be able to get a single woman today who would want to wear such a hat, but back then, that's what all women aspired to own and wear. If you have the chance, Google up a few images when you have time. The plumage used often came from birds in the Florida Everglades, and many species literally were at the precipice of extinction due to overhunting to fuel the fashion industry. When I say it was big business, there's no exaggeration at all. At the peak, plumes sold for $32 an ounce, which was literally the same price as gold. Hunters largely targeted adult birds in the spring, when the feathers were at their colorful finest. This also happened to be when they were on their nests. Adult birds were collected and chicks were left to starve. Some hunters collected hundreds of birds per day. Things were looking pretty darn bleak. And then along came Paul. Paul Krogel, that is. There were a few other individuals who were fighting the good fight, but one of the most influential and polarizing was a German immigrant from East Central Florida named Paul Krogel. Krogel had moved to Florida in 1881. He was fascinated with the pelicans on the island in the bay in front of where he lived. During the late 1800s, as Pelican Island's pelican populations were being hammered into oblivion by plume hunters, Krogel decided to take a stand. Too many times we think to ourselves, what can one person do, right? Yeah, that apparently didn't cross his mind. Though there were no state or federal laws to assist him, he decided to take control of the situation himself. He was a smallish man, with a big hat, a big gun, and an even bigger plan. Each day, Krogel would take his double-barrel 10-gauge and sail to the island to stand guard and protect the birds. A very risky proposition, given that people were actually killed due to the competition for plumes. His dedication did not go unnoticed. A few prominent ornithologists took up his cause. These men were influential on a national level and led a campaign to pass laws for the protection of non-game birds. Two men in particular, Frank Chapman and William Dutcher, took the cause directly to President Theodore Roosevelt, who was already pretty keen on conservation efforts. On March 14, 1903, amidst virtually no fanfare, Roosevelt signed an executive order establishing Pelican Island as the first national wildlife refuge. Actually, initially it was labeled a federal bird reservation, and the name was later changed to a wildlife refuge. Irrespective, it was the first time in U.S. history that the federal government set aside land specifically for the sake of wildlife. A part of the language of that executive order reads as follows. It is hereby ordered that Pelican Island in Indian River is hereby reserved and set apart for the use of the Department of Agriculture as a preserve and breeding ground for native birds. And, as they say, the rest is history. After Pelican Island, Roosevelt went on to sign into being 55 refuges during his presidency, which kind of spells out how strongly he felt about the need to be proactive when it came to our nation's wildlife resources. Today, that number sits at a robust 562, and it continues to grow. Many people considered Roosevelt quite the visionary, particularly with regards to conservation. But it's quite possible that even he could not have imagined what the refuge system would go on to become. That said, I'm pretty sure he'd be mighty proud. And what about Paul Krogel? He continued to live in the area until the end of his days and had a dedicated interest in area birds until the end as well. After Pelican Island was awarded refuge status, Krogel was hired as the first ever refuge manager for a national wildlife refuge. Alas, Congress didn't set aside funds for costs associated with it, so his salary was initially paid by the Florida Audubon Society. His salary? He was paid a whopping $1 per month. Eventually, that hard-earned dollar was paid by the U.S. government, and he received another $7 a month from Audubon to protect the birds. If that still sounds pretty paltry, it is and was, and he was forced to supplement his income with monies from boat building and farming. One of his first duties was to erect a large sign declaring the island a refuge, but he had to take that sign down because its size scared off birds. Not a good way to start. He also put up a 50-foot flagpole so people could see it was a federal property. When asked about the boundaries to the refuge, he once said that it amounted to anything in the surrounding waters within range of his 10-gauge. He continued to defend the refuge and birds until he officially retired in 1919. Unofficially, he continued his protection until his death. He remained active in local matters and politics until he passed away in 1948. A statue and a monument to his efforts can be seen in Sebastian, Florida. Togiak Refuge is but one of 562 refuges spread across the United States and its territories that will celebrate National Wildlife Refuge Week next week. We are an impressive refuge, though, at 4.7 million acres, the fourth largest in the whole system, and with much of the refuge covered in actual wilderness. But it all started with a German immigrant and a tiny 3-acre island in Florida 112 years ago. For what it's worth, my very first Field Notes episode, which aired 8 years ago this week, was a 3-minute episode over Pelican Island. It's been really fun to revisit the topic today. Thanks for tuning in. Have a terrific weekend. And next week, happy National Wildlife Refuge Week. Buy a soda or a coffee and raise it in recognition of Paul Krogel. And if you haven't already, help out today's fashions. If you wear a flat-billed hat, put a curve to it. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake, provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.